Hello. Late last year, Sir James Munby, head of the Family Division of the High Court of Justice in England and Wales, gave a speech in which he argued three main points. He said that Britain has a secular law system. He said that courts no longer recognise religious distinctions. And thirdly, he asserted that, and I quote, happily, judges no longer enforce morality. His comments were debated in the press for weeks and earned him the nickname the High Priest of Secularism. So is Munby right? Is the law of the United Kingdom no longer Christian? Joining me to discuss the role of religion in our legal system are Sir Mark Headley, a former High Court judge, the legal commentator Joshua Rosenberg, and David McElroy, a barrister who teaches the theology of law at Spurgeon's College London. Now, Munby suggested that our legal system is now secular. Is he right, Mark?
Well, I think he's right in the sense that it's secular because it's a system for everyone. But the idea that it's devoid of morality seems to me questionable at least.
Joshua?
It's certainly based on morality. It's secular, though, in the sense that although there are certain privileges, for example, in relation to the formalities of marriage for certain religious groups, it won't allow religion to provide a defence to the general law. So, for example, you can't, and this is one of Munby's examples, you can't commit female genital mutilation and say that you have a religious justification for doing that.
David, interesting that neither Joshua or Mark mentioned Christian morality.
Our society and its laws are, to an extent that we don't really realise, based on Christian principles. Many of the things that we hold dear, like the Magna Carta, the idea of democracy, even some aspects of human rights, those things are derived from the Christian influence on our country's laws. And we know from examples around the world that things might not have turned out that way if there hadn't been Christian influence.
What did that mean in practical terms in the Middle Ages? How did the Christian basis of the law influence society?
Well, in many ways, during the Middle Ages, you have two parallel systems running at the same time. The king has his courts and the church has his courts. And so there's a competition. You can go to court and complain in front of the king. You can go to court and complain in front of the church. So sometimes the church is an effective rival to government, and sometimes it's an effective critic of government.
And even at that time, Mark, there was a battle between the two, because very often the secular courts, or the king's courts, went into battle with the church courts over which one had the right to have a superior position.
And that goes all the way back to Henry II and Thomas à Becket, and the conflicts that arose then. And the courts did indeed proceed in parallel thereafter. There was never a time after that when the secular courts were under the control of the church.
The Reformation was the big turning point, I guess, when all changed, because the king was then the supreme governor of the church and the king's courts took over from the church courts, David.
That's right. The king takes over everything at that stage. He's responsible, to an even greater extent than in the Middle Ages, for appointing bishops. The things that the church courts were doing, those courts get subsumed within the legal system. And it's very, very clear from that point onwards till around the 19th century that to be an Anglican is to be a first-class citizen in the UK, and everybody else is just tolerated.
And that involved everyone, Joshua. Unless you're an Anglican, you were sort of outside the pale.
Yes, and Jews in particular were hardly to be reckoned with at all. But you've seen this steady progression. I mean, for example, after the year 1222, the ecclesiastical courts used to hear claims of defamation, but from the early years of the 16th century, the ecclesiastical jurisdiction was slowly eroded away. They lost defamation, they lost all sorts of things, and really all that remains now is disciplinary jurisdiction over the clergy and oversight of church property, for example. And although the church courts still exist, they're not going to concern people who are not directly involved in the church.
There were a lot of changes in the 19th century to bring things a little more up to date, David. For instance, there was legislation that brought about equality within the law.
There are two very contradictory things that are happening in the 19th century. On the one hand, you see Wellington introducing the Emancipation of Catholics Act in 1829, and then similar measures in relation to Jews coming in 1846. So many of the privileges that Anglicanism brought with it are dismantled in the first half of the 19th century. And yet at the same time, you see this extraordinary moral crusade, some of the fruits of which Sir James Mumby picks up on and rightly criticises, but which also gives us things like the Factories Act and legislation to deal with abusive working conditions for children and women. It gives us the NSPCC, the RSPCA, a whole load of things really explode as Christian morality is pushed in public in the second half of the 19th century.
Mark?
And also gives us the beginning of the humanisation of the criminal law as well. So that you have a very strong moral content in a lot of the legislative process, which is picked up often in judicial language. But it would be, I think, misleading simply to concentrate on personal morality. It would extend it much more widely than that.
But I find it interesting, David, that with all this legislation about equality before the law in the Victorian times, there was also a lot of legislation about private morality.
Well, I think there's legislation of morality all over the place. Some of it we find entirely acceptable. It seems to us obvious that work should be work conditions should be regulated, but that historically would have been regarded as something private. We also see the beginning of movement towards universal education and universal health care, and that's promoted on moral grounds. And somehow for the Victorians, the legislation of personal private morality, as we would see it today, is part of a piece. It's about dealing with and controlling and regulating human conduct in all sorts of areas.
But not in a religious form. I mean, what we're saying, surely, is that state and the church are so intertwined that religious principles are being enforced by the state, but not necessarily for Christians, for everybody, and for reasons that could be described as secular.
Yes, I think that's right, Joshua. I think it's not that it's being done because there's a moral crusade by the Church of England, or indeed any Christian church. I think there is a widespread moral consensus, which is shared by lots of people of different faiths and no faith at all, which is leading to this.
And one of the things that Munby points out is that it was a very biased form of morality. It was a morality in favour of men. If a woman committed adultery, she might lose custody of her child. If a man committed adultery, well, that was perfectly normal.
Now, that moral consensus fell apart in the 1960s, and all of a sudden everything was up in the air. And I can remember the days when, of Mary Whitehouse, the Festival of Light, which in retrospect seems to be a last desperate attempt to take a stand for Christian morality in public life.
Yes, for example, Munby refers not only to Larkin's comment, sexual intercourse began in 1963, but he dates it to 1961, when there was a case which all law students remember, the Ladies' Directory case, Shaw and the DPP, which was about somebody who published a booklet containing names and addresses and telephone numbers of prostitutes and other details related to that, and he was convicted of this unheard-of offence of conspiracy to corrupt public morals. We wouldn't do that these days.
David?
That's right, but there's also something odd going on there, because that's judges making criminal law. And as we've seen with the Labour government introducing 3,000 new criminal offences today, judges would be more than happy to leave the task of introducing new criminal offences to the legislature. So there's something going on there with the last great stand of the judges setting themselves out to make new law, I think.
Is there also something going on about the fact that throughout history from the Middle Ages onwards, judges held to a Christian worldview, even if they didn't always attempt to impose that? After the 1960s, that certainly was no longer the case, Mark.
Well, there's something in that, in the sense that, that there's no doubt that it wasn't the influence of the institutional church that was behind so many of the developments in Victorian times and the early part of the 20th century. It was the fact that judges and legislators grew up with a commonly accepted morality, which was Judeo-Christian, as influenced by classical scholarship as well. It's important that all those three were in the mix, and that provided, as it were, a common basis on which everybody who exercised power and authority in the political and legal sphere almost entirely worked, even if they themselves had no personal religious belief, as many did not.
Let's bring it right up to the present day. If I were to say, for instance, that The Queen is still obviously head of the church and state. They have an established church. There are 26 bishops sitting in the Lords. Apart from that, how much influence does the church have on actual lawmaking, Joshua?
I don't think it has a great deal. I don't see the bishops ganging up in the House of Lords to block legislation. They obviously speak in debates when they think it's appropriate. But you may well say it's anomalous that they should have any role in the House of Lords. They have an institutional role, but there are other faith leaders who happen to be appointed as peers, and it's quite reasonable that all points of view should be expressed in the upper chamber. But the Queen can't personally make laws. The Church of England can't directly influence lawmaking. We do have an established church, but it doesn't stop people of all religions and none being able to go about their daily lives in accordance with procedures and laws and principles that I think most normal people would regard as perfectly acceptable.
But Joshua, can we say we have a secular legal system as long as those 26 bishops sit in the House of Lords?
Strictly speaking, no. But then, the system isn't as clear-cut as purists would wish. It's practically secular. It's secular in practical terms in the sense that I mentioned at the beginning, which is that you can't rely on your religious beliefs to stop something which the courts think is appropriate. I'm sure Mark Headley, when he was a judge, would have had cases like Jehovah's Witnesses who didn't want their children to have blood transfusions, and Mark would have said, I must act in the best interests of the child. You can't have female genital mutilation. You can't have what is grotesquely called honour killings or honour attacks on people, and sometimes even a religious marriage is declared improper if the person concerned didn't have capacity. So the secular side of society will trump religion in all but the most trivial, they may be important to the individuals, but trivial matters.
David, there was a doctrine called the Doctrine of the Two that existed in Roman times, whereby Christians recognised that at that stage they were a minority with the Roman Empire, but they could coexist alongside the state. Just explain the doctrine to me.
Well, it goes right back to Jesus, really. Jesus doesn't come and try and take political power off Herod and Pilate. And so the church, right from the beginning, has not seen taking political power as being kind of essential to its mission. Now, that's very different from the experience of Islam with Muhammad, who does very clearly found a state and a political order. So Christianity and Islam have sort of written into their foundational DNA different approaches. The doctrine of the two says, well, there is a church and there is a state, and one of them has responsibilities that are concerned with things that are eternal and spiritual, and the other one has responsibilities that are concerned with things that are material and temporary.
Well, let me remind you that you're listening to Beyond Belief, and today I'm discussing Christianity and the law with Mark Headley, who's a former High Court judge, the legal commentator Joshua Rosenberg, and David McElroy, a barrister who also teaches the theology of law. Alison Ruoff is a Christian and a member of the Church of England's General Synod. She recently retired as a lay magistrate after serving on the bench for more than 20 years. I asked her whether her Christian faith influenced the way she went about her work as a magistrate.
Oh, definitely. In many respects, sometimes when you'd go into the retiring room, I'd find myself sending up an arrow prayer, please, Lord, I need wisdom. And I just think the fact that you take an oath to be absolutely fair and to do right to all is carrying out the Christian stance of love your neighbour as yourself and to follow the law and to do your very best for God and for others.
Did you think it was part of your role to enforce morality?
No, the thing that one has to do as a magistrate is to uphold the law, and you work that out with the help of your colleagues, and you are there to do a job as a magistrate and to do it to the very best of your ability, no matter who you are.
Well, let me express it negatively. Did you ever feel that you had to leave your Christian convictions behind you when you went into the bench?
No, I don't think so. But I was very much aware that when same-sex adoption came in, that I would be in difficulty as a Christian, because I could not have sat and done a same-sex adoption because my Christian faith wouldn't have allowed me to do that. So I knew that the writing was on the wall as regards my remaining on the bench. And in fact, I understand that there are one or two magistrates who've had to leave because they couldn't work in that way.
The logical conclusion of that is that you think it's quite difficult for a Christian to sit as a magistrate in their family court anymore.
Well, if those cases come up, yes, it is. At least I think it is. It would be for me. But I suppose other people have different views and they're prepared to go along with what the law says you must do. So, I mean, I used to love doing adoptions. It was just brilliant to see these children going to lovely, caring families they'd been living with. And the joy of those occasions in the courts was just marvellous.
Now, recently there's been a move to remove the oath that witnesses and defendants take to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help me God, swearing on the Bible.
Yes.
It did fail, but what did you think of that?
Well, I had no intention of going to go to the magistrates' annual meeting in Cardiff, but when that came up, I thought to myself, as a Christian, I need to try and go. So I did. And I have to say that when I did, the whole meeting woke up because I spoke with some degree of passion. But I was totally opposed to it because already there is a secular oath that you can take. And it's just, in my opinion, one more step against the marginalisation of Christianity in this country.
Is the marginalisation of Christianity and Christians, which you've identified, a problem for the legal system or society in general?
I think it's both. I think it's coming more and more into the legal system, and we must not abandon Christianity in this country because it is the root of what is really important of Christian ethics and the way our values have been based on Christian principles over the years.
That was Alison Ruoff, and the crunch came, Mark, over same-sex adoption, and there she came up against a fundamental moral principle in which she was not prepared to compromise. I wonder, have you ever sat in court and sanctioned things with which you were not entirely happy?
I'm sure I have, and that would be one of them. But I think very often when you're confronted with these issues, your obligation is to act in the interests of the child. And my task, as I saw it, was if I could leave a child in a better place than I found the child, then I acted. In all the same-sex cases I did, the child had been part of that family for a long time before the adoption. There was nowhere else for this child to go. And it seemed to me that it would simply fly in the face of reality and fly in the face of what was right for that child to leave the child in legal limbo.
Joshua?
I must say, I have a lot of respect for what Alison Ruoff was saying, although I might refer to Judeo-Christian principles, although we're thinking about the same thing. We are losing something, aren't we, if we are losing these fundamental approaches to morality, which have served this country very well. I can see that we need to. I can see that the law must be secular, that we live in a multicultural society, and we must respect people's beliefs, and we mustn't impose religious beliefs on those who don't share them, and that's not the role of the law. But I can see that what Alison Ruoff says will get a lot of support from people who feel that the old order is changing and we're going to be worse off as a result of it.
I think many people might say, should there not be an opportunity for somebody like Alison Ruoff to opt out of that particular case when her personal morals, she feels, are being compromised?
In practice, magistrates' courts may well operate to that extent. This arose, of course, in the case of registrars, there was one in particular who was unwilling to preside over a civil partnership ceremony. And you can argue that, well, if you take the job of registering marriages and births and deaths and civil partnerships and shortly gay marriages, well, if you take that job, that's the job you must do, and you can't say, I won't do this one because it doesn't accord with my religious faith. So you can see that people are entitled to expect that registrars will comply with the law once it's been approved by Parliament. But yes, it would be a shame, it was a shame perhaps, that somebody like Alison Ruoff could no longer continue on the bench, if only because perhaps she could have given up doing family cases and just done criminal cases.
Mark Munby said that the values that judges bring to the bench are what they think that reasonable people in society are thinking at that time.
Yes, he also says that actually there aren't necessarily shared moral views even amongst reasonable people. So you have an immediate conflict in which decisions have to be made and values applied. So you get a case, say, where you're dealing with the welfare of children, where actually everybody may be putting forward perfectly reasonable grounds, but they don't live together, so choices have to be made. And the choices are made not on purely practical grounds, but employing a value-laden concept called the best interest of the child or the welfare of the child. And it's the content, it's where we get the content of welfare or best interests that seems to me a critical question. That must have a moral, ethical content to it.
But in a diverse society like ours, that's very difficult to arrive at any consensus about what those moral values might be.
Exactly so, which is why judges actually can't just ask themselves, as they could, say, in the 1950s, what are the agreed values of society which I apply to the facts of this case? Now, actually, some choices have to be made in which the judge's value system becomes engaged with what can be understood to be the communal value system insofar as it exists in the social order with which the judge is dealing at the time. So you will get conflict, you will get the need to make choices. Classic cases are, for example, when you're asked to sanction the turning off of a machine so that a small, very sick child dies or is likely to die. Now, it seems to me there isn't a common view about what is right in those circumstances, that there are value judgments to be made which involve colossal issues like life and death that judges are required to engage with.
David, let me put it to you that if you take away Christian moral values as the foundation of legal judgments, what happens at the basis of the law, you've got to replace it with something. And critics say that what's happened is you have put a rather vague concept of human rights.
Well, that vague concept of human rights is itself fundamentally Christian in origin. The philosopher John Gray wrote in BBC News magazine that human rights go back to John Locke, and John Locke only thought we had human rights because we were made by God. So one of the paradoxes of human rights is that it only really makes sense if there is a God somehow underwriting those rights. Otherwise, they're simply a human invention, and that means that they're incredibly fragile because you need them to stop government doing nasty things to you. But if government doesn't respect them, then you've got nowhere of grounding them.
But they are a human invention. You know, they were agreed by, if you talk about the European Convention on Human Rights, it was signed by a number of countries in the early 1950s. The UK was heavily involved in drafting them. You can look at the people who drafted the individual rights in the Human Rights Convention. And you don't have to have religious faith to support human rights, and they stand separately, and they would be supported by many who have no religious faith at all.
And there is a huge divergence of opinion as to what constitutes a human right or not. We've already touched on the issue of female genital mutilation, for instance. There would be some people who would argue that it is their religious right to impose that on a female child.
Yes, I'd be very interested to hear someone try and make a religious case for it as opposed to a cultural case for it. I don't believe there's any religious justification in Islam for doing it. But there may be in the cultural accretions that have accumulated around Islam in certain areas. But I think when we say we use human rights, as it were, as the substitute for a Christian value system, in fact, on a daily basis, in family courts and courts of protection, it's concepts of welfare and best interests, which are the really powerful, decisive concepts that on which judgments are actually based. And human rights are helpful as far as they go, but human rights legislation provides almost no guidance about how you deal with conflicting human rights, in other words, where people's human rights have come into conflict with each other, as will almost always happen in a separating family.
Or even the issue of when freedom of religion is subordinate to the rights of a minority.
Yes.
Joshua?
That's absolutely right. The Human Rights Convention is full of great principles, all of which have to be, or most of which have to be, taken against each other. So, you know, freedom of expression has to be balanced against the right to privacy. Freedom to hold religious views is absolute, but freedom to profess religious views is limited for the reasons that Mark has explained. So that is inevitable, and there you rely on the judges to balance conflicting rights, and there you rely on the judge's feeling for justice, which is bound to be influenced by his or her upbringing, the society in which he or she lives, and no doubt the religious faith or lack thereof of the judge concerned.
If we have a secular legal system, and I think we're all more or less agreed that we do, what are the key principles on which that is based, Mark?
Well, I think the key principles are principles which I think have underpinned our legal system for endless times, all about truth and honesty and fairness and justice and the protection of those less able to protect themselves from those who are strong and abusing their strength.
Not so very different from Christian principles,
well,
then.
But precisely so, and I think it's almost inevitable that because of the history of this country that Christian principles will have instilled themselves quite apart from their religious content in the consciousness of thinking people. And so it shouldn't be at all surprising that principles that appear to have Christian origins should regularly be seen around. How could they not, given our history?
That must be very reassuring to you, David.
Well, the comedian Dara O'Brien says he's an atheist, but he's a Catholic atheist. And I think that many of us find ourselves in that situation today, that the British values that we think we hold because they're British values are in fact values that Judaism and Christianity have taught us as a society. And so many of the things those reasonable people that Sir James Mumby spoke about, that they hold to today, still are, to a certain extent, values that we've got because of the religious influences on our culture over hundreds of years.
Joshua?
Yes, that's right. That must be the case. There are a lot of people who are concerned that those values are slipping away. And it perhaps is the job of the courts to try to preserve those values, not because they're religious values, but because they're universal values.
Well, there we must bring this discussion to an end. My thanks to Joshua Rosenberg, David McElroy and Mark Headley. I'll be back at the same time next week with another edition of Beyond Belief. I hope you'll join me.